Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yemen is capturing international attention after the January 29th U.S. raid that killed civilians and a Navy SEAL. According to the New York Times, grisly photographs of children killed in the crossfire of a 50-minute firefight during the raid caused outrage in Yemen. A member of the Navy SEALs Team 6, Chief Petty Officer William Owens, was also killed in the operation. Medics at the scene said 30 people died, including 10 women and children. It was the first military action authorized by Donald Trump. U.S. military officials told Reuters that he approved the action without sufficient intelligence, ground support, or adequate backup. A senior military official told NBC News that almost everything went wrong. The Guardian reports that the mission was approved over a dinner 5 days after the inauguration by Trump and his closest advisors, including his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and former Breitbart executive, Steve Bannon. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about U.S. policy in Yemen. This did not start with Donald Trump. Almost 2 years ago, the United States began backing the Saudi military attack on Yemen, which has killed more than 10,000 people and has forced millions to flee their homes in search of safety. 19 million people are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. Under Barack Obama, U.S. involvement in Yemen escalated. The United States conducted 38 drone strikes last year and at least five this year. In December, senior UN official Jamie McGoldrick said, quote, "The politics of the situation has overcome the humanity. The world has turned a blind eye to what's happening in Yemen. Right now, we are so under-resourced for this crisis. It's extraordinary," end quote. So what do we need to know about U.S. policy in Yemen under Barack Obama, and what can we expect under Donald Trump? Today we're joined by two guests to talk about this humanitarian crisis. Shabia Mantu is the UN Refugee Agency spokesperson in Yemen, a lawyer and journalist by profession. Shabia has served previously with UNHCR in Iraq, London, and Geneva. And Shabia joins us on the line from Yemen. Hi, Shabia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Sheila Carapico, a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. Sheila is a contributing editor of the Middle East Report and has written extensively about Yemen. She's the editor of Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. And Sheila joins us on the line from Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Sheila. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for your interest in the subject.
Well, it got a lot of attention after that January 29th raid. We did a couple of shows last year, but it doesn't get that much attention. Shabia, I want to start with you. You posted a video that you took online, and it's a video of Sada, a city on the front lines of the conflict in Yemen. I mean, the images are so striking. Buildings have been reduced to complete rubble. In the video, we learn that 19 million people are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. You're in Yemen right now. Tell us what life is like on the ground there.
Yeah, that's correct. I did take the video in Sada, and I'm on the ground in Yemen at the moment. I think what strikes me is the fact that we are dealing with one of the world's worst humanitarian crises here in Yemen, and the fact is that the attention and support in Yemen is completely disproportionate when you look at the situation here on the ground. There are currently almost 19 million people in need of humanitarian assistance that's been brought about by the conflict. We are seeing, you know, real scenes of desperation. It's taken a huge toll on civilians. The war has impacted almost every household in Yemen in some way, shape, or form. And we've seen tens of thousands of civilian casualties. We've seen mass displacement. At the moment, we see that we have 2 million people who are actually still displaced across Yemen. We also have 1 million people who were displaced. But the conditions of the country in both sites of displacement and of origin are equally as bad. So people are just having to make a difficult decision to say, well, look, the situation is not safe anywhere, and I may as well just return home. So we're seeing, I mean, you see devastation, you see desperation, and you see a full-blown humanitarian catastrophe. And so for us, there's a huge disconnect in terms of the international attention and support on the crisis and what the situation looks like on the ground.
And Yemen has a population of 24 million people, already considered the poorest country in the region before these attacks and this war. Can you talk a little bit about the humanitarian aid situation there? What is that like on the ground?
Well, the humanitarian response has been mobilized in response to the crisis, and there are staggering needs. So we are prioritizing the response to really aim to ensure that we are able to cover those that are most in need of assistance and protection. But even so, I mean, if we look at today, the funding situation and the support is abysmal. For us, as UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, we're already 2 months into the year, and our funding situation at the moment to respond to humanitarian needs in Yemen is only 1% funded, and that is absolutely staggering. Mm. So we are under real pressure to be able to respond to the crisis, but we are severely limited in terms of the funding and the support we receive. So we keep on saying this is actually one of the world's worst humanitarian crises, and the fact that there is such scant regard for the needs in Yemen, it is absolutely devastating, and it will have real consequences, not only now but also in the future. It will take decades to really rebuild Yemen again and to recover from the conflict. So it's a small investment by supporting the humanitarian response now, but there seems to be some short-sightedness in being able to for the international community to mobilize as much as it would need to.
The UN is appealing for $2 billion as millions of people face famine. According to the UN Children's Fund, 63,000 Yemeni children died last year of preventable causes.
Well, we're seeing that, a combination of conflict, deteriorating conditions, the economic situation as well, as also the living conditions. When we look at the main needs for displaced people, for instance, we see that the main needs are really primary basic needs. We're talking about things like food, water, shelter. So if you're struggling already with basic needs and these are essentially leading to a struggle for survival, we are definitely going to see many more diseases, many more problems. We had a cholera outbreak last year as well as a result of war and also the conditions that are conducive for the proliferation of these types of problems. So definitely we will see many more secondary and tertiary consequences arising as a result of the conflict and the lack of adequate assistance to respond to the needs here.
Of the $2 billion that is needed, you said only 1% has been received. What explains that?
Well, this is 1% received only by UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. So as part of this system-wide appeal, each agency also have their own funding requirements. But for us, UNHCR, for our response, it's only been 1% funded, and we're already in February, as I mentioned. So we are ringing the alarm bells and saying, we really need to ensure that we are properly supported this year. But otherwise, there are going to be severe limitations on our capacity to respond to life-saving emergency needs.
And Sheila, we're going to talk with you a little later in the show about the politics and the U.S. policy in Yemen. But first, what would you add about this just horrific humanitarian crisis that's happening on the ground?
Well, Shabia has done such a great job, but I would add a couple of points. One is that you cited the number of 10,000 deaths, which, as far as I know, we've been citing that same number now for almost a year, which cannot be accurate. And secondly, that those are kind of known deaths in hospitals, mainly from trauma from warfare, and they do not take into account, as far as I know, other deaths from starvation or preventable diseases. So I think that number is probably misleadingly low. And, the second point, and we'll come back to this on the politics, is that, the international donors, including the United States, the United Kingdom, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, certainly. I mean, they're partly responsible for this crisis and their inability or unwillingness to help the aid agencies, including UNHCR, is something that I hope we would call attention to.
Yes, and we'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. Again, Shabia, Yemen is a country of 24 million people. How much of the country has been affected by this war?
Well, we see that there are several different layers and effects in terms of the consequences of the conflict. But I think, from our estimation, we see that when we talk to people on the ground and from all walks of life here in Yemen, you see that the conflict has touched them in some way. So we're seeing, nearly every single household in Yemen has been affected by the culmination of the conflict and all the consequences, the deteriorating economic situation, also the impact on the public sector and civilian infrastructure and services. So there are consequences all around, whether it's consequences in terms of people actually physically being displaced or injured or affected directly as a result of the conflict, or whether they are suffering in terms of the exacerbation of poverty and of other conditions. So we are seeing it's a widespread crisis, and if you look at the way in which people are living, and there are active hostilities that are happening, so you actually do hear the sounds of warfare. It's visible. You can see the destruction, I think, in the clip that you alluded to earlier, the one that I had taken from Sada. Sada is one of the cities that has been particularly impacted by conflict, but there are many other Sadas in Yemen. We have other governorates, and they all, if they're not affected by war, by also terrorism, violence, insecurity, it's become a melting pot of all these different types of conditions. And as I like to say, it's an inventory of misery, basically, because each problem is conducive to one that's happening. So we're seeing a multi-layered crisis. It's permeating everywhere. So it's impacting virtually every single household in Yemen is being impacted by the war and the situation here.
Can you tell us about how the infrastructure of Yemen has been affected? According to the BBC, 50% of medical facilities no longer function. Some have been bombed by the Saudi-led coalition. Others have ground to a halt because there's no funding. Key roads and bridges are frequently attacked, making the delivery of assistance even more difficult.
Well, Yemen faces a complex humanitarian crisis, and definitely the infrastructure is one of those casualties. So we see insecurity, we see conflict, we also see water scarcity, extreme poverty, and then you also see rising prices, economic difficulties, and then the effect on that on the population. There's an estimation, for instance, that 30% of Yemen Yemen's population are dependent on public sector salaries, and as a result of the conflict and the political situation, people are suffering. They don't have livelihood opportunities. People are just relying on their savings. They're resorting to also negative coping mechanisms to help them survive. So the conflict has taken a major toll on civilians and civilian infrastructure. I mean, hospitals, the education system. There are also estimates that 2 million children are now out of school because of the conflict. So it's widespread, and we are going to see the effects of this for decades and generations to come if this is not addressed urgently and adequately.
Shabi Amantu is the UN Refugee Agency spokesperson in Yemen. Sorry about her line there, but she is joining us from Yemen to talk about what the humanitarian situation looks like on the ground. We're also joined by Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond and contributing editor of the Middle East Report. And again, Yemen got attention in the U.S. media because of the January 29th U.S. raid, which killed 30 people. Many headlines are calling this a botched raid. We're learning from outlets like Reuters that Donald Trump approved this action without sufficient intelligence, ground support, or adequate backup. We're learning from The Guardian that Trump approved the raid over dinner with Jared Kushner and Steve Bannon, but this did not start with Donald Trump. The U.S. began backing the Saudi military attack on Yemen about 2 years ago, and in fact, under Barack Obama, the U.S. escalated drone strikes. It didn't get that much attention under Barack Obama. We did a couple of shows about it, but not that much attention unless you really looked for it. What questions do you have about what's happening on the ground in Yemen? Shabia will be with us for a couple more minutes, and then we'll talk more about the politics behind this. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Shabia, what is the responsibility of Saudi Arabia, for example, the United States, the countries that are bombing Yemen and droning Yemen? What is the responsibility of these countries to fund the, to also add money to the $2 billion that's needed to deal with this humanitarian crisis?
Well, I think it's not really sort of our place to apportion responsibility for funding. These are voluntary contributions that come from governments across the world, and we're appealing not only to governments but to the international community as a whole to sort of stand in solidarity with Yemen, to support Yemen financially, but also in other ways in terms of finding a political solution and supporting the political process to resolve the Yemen conflict. So on one hand, there definitely is a huge need and an immediate need for funding support from various donors, and we are very grateful for the donors and the international community that has been supporting our efforts in Yemen to date. But there is also another element in terms of support for Yemen, and that is to ensure that we can support a peaceful political resolution to the crisis, because that is the other major thing that will help end suffering and then work towards rebuilding the future of Yemen. So there are two facets, I mean, the funding situation and then also ensuring that we support the efforts that are underway to seek peace for the crisis.
And Shabia, you're in Yemen. What are you hearing from people on the ground about what they're experiencing and the stories they want you and the UN to tell?
Well, overwhelmingly, the main message that I get from people is, you know, why don't people care about us in Yemen like they do in other countries? Why is our suffering ignored? And this is a huge complaint and sort of an honest question that they keep on asking us. When I went to Sada, you know, earlier this week, people were actually quite passionate and really upset, and they said, why doesn't anyone care about the people of Yemen? Why is there no international support? And they see that. They consume television. They can see the reporting on other conflicts and crises. There's definitely a feeling of neglect. And for us as well, I mean, I can tell you in terms of the coverage that Yemen receives, it is quite disproportionate. It tends usually or often traditionally is focused on the security paradigm, looking at the counterterrorism element, looking at the conflict perspective, but there's very little attention on what the suffering is on a human level and how people in Yemen are trying to cope with the conflict, how they're just trying to rebuild their lives. And, you know, many people, if you ask them, I ask nearly every single person I meet when I do stories or I go out into the field, and I say, you know, what are your hopes and your dreams for the future? And many of them, especially those that are displaced, they say, we just want to return home. We want to go back to our jobs. We miss our extended family and our friends, and we don't want to hear the sounds of conflict. So this is basically the main message is that they want a sense of normalcy. They want to go back to life, and they want the conflict to end. And at the same time, there's a huge level of fatigue and exhaustion. We're now counting towards almost 2 years of the current conflict, and people are incredibly exhausted of having to live with that. There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of trauma as well. So it's a mixture of exhaustion and also unhappiness and just a feeling of neglect that their suffering is not recognized by the world.
Sheila, do you have a question for Sabia before we let her go?
Wow, I mean, it must be so profound to be living under those circumstances. So I guess my question is, you know, how does she respond to those people? You must acknowledge, Shabia, that it's true that not very many people are paying attention, but do you find a way to give them a message of hope?
Well, the thing that we focus on and what we're trying to do is really to bring attention to the crisis and also show what the conflict is on a human level. So we try and tell the stories of people who have been displaced. I mean, we keep on talking about situations and developments in Yemen that are affecting people. I mean, most recently we have a situation, for instance, in the governorate of Taiz, there's intense fighting and there's renewed displacement. We have more than 30,000 people being freshly displaced by a new round of hostilities and violence. And when we get these messages out and we get news out, there's still very little appetite. But for us, I mean, the onus is on us as the people on the ground and as a humanitarian agency to make sure that the people in whose name we are there to serve and work for, that their stories and their messages can also be relayed to the world. So that is a way in which we're able to bring to the world attention on Yemen and what it means and how life is on the ground here for people who are affected by the conflict.
Shabia, before we let you go, we have an email from Carl who says, can you give any recommendations on which aid organizations are most effective on the ground in Yemen and should be supported?
Well, there are a number of aid agencies working on the crisis in Yemen and that are on the ground. I mean, I would obviously appeal for my agency. We work for the benefit of various populations in Yemen. So we're responding to the needs of people who've been displaced by the conflict. And so we're talking about 3 million people in total who have been uprooted from their homes, 2 million people that are still displaced, and 1 million people that are trying to return home. We are also there responding to refugees in Yemen. So Yemen has been a traditionally very generous country, and it's accepted with open arms people who have been escaping persecution in the Horn of Africa. And to date, we have you know, more than 280,000 refugees and asylum seekers in Yemen. And where they're responding to the needs, where they're responding to local communities, to displaced communities. So we have a very operational response and we're present across the country. So you can definitely look into our operations. But by all means, there are many other agencies in the appeal that's been launched this week as well by the UN. There, you will see a profile of all the different agencies that are there responding to a crisis. But we all face severe challenges in ensuring that we have adequate support. So you can look at the humanitarian response plan, and you can also take a look at UNHCR and see which agency or mandates and kind of programs you'd be interested in looking at. But there are a variety of international and local and international NGOs also working on the ground in Yemen.
Well, Shabia, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for the work you're doing, and we will definitely continue to follow this.
Thank you. It's been great speaking to you.
Thank you. Shabia Mantou is the UN Refugee Agency spokesperson in Yemen. She was joining us on the line from Yemen. You can follow her on Facebook and Twitter, and she's been taking videos of what she's seen, short videos, and then talking about the humanitarian crisis. According to the official numbers, more than 10,000 people in Yemen have been killed. Millions have been forced to flee their homes in search of safety. 19 million people are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, contributing editor of the Middle East Report. She's written extensively about Yemen. She's the editor of Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. And we wanted to spend the first part of the show with Shabia talking about the humanitarian crisis on the ground. And now we're going to talk about the politics. We've got a question from Franz in San Rafael just about what this conflict is about. Hi, Franz. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
First, I'd like to tell you I'm a combat veteran, United States Navy, Vietnam era. This is unfortunately looking like one of the ludicrous escapades that we've gotten ourselves in. Yeah, a lot of it is politics, but unfortunately, I'm going to tell you right now, a lot of it is also big money. Mm. They would like to tell you, I'm sure, that there are a lot of people that benefit financially as far as jobs, and that's smoke and mirrors, because it's essentially a very capital intensive. It's not labor intensive, and the weapons that they're selling to Saudi Arabia is huge, almost obscene amounts of money. I fail to see why if you don't tell the American people really what is going on, then they of course are in the dark, and these things are allowed to continue. It's the same thing. I have actually an attitude that if people were to see visually, as far as reports, video reports and things such as this, of the actions that had and the results of the actions that occur, there would definitely be some people standing up against these sorts of actions.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. You brought up a few things there. And why don't we talk about the weapon sales in just a minute? But first, Sheila, I wanted to talk first with Shabia with the UN about the humanitarian crisis and then talk with you about the politics. Because this doesn't get that much attention in the U.S. media, can you give us some history here? How did this all start?
Well, like any other complex conflict, I mean, the history is kind of long and convoluted, but, you know, very briefly, as part of the Arab Spring, there was an uprising against a dictator, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who's, was widespread, virtually nationwide uprising, calling for the downfall of the regime. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and other Gulf monarchies kind of stepped in and tried to patch together an interim solution where Saleh's vice president, nominally now the president, Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi, became the transitional leader. He was extremely ineffectual. In September 2014, a kind of ragtag militia from an obscure northern area sort of began protesting and basically was able, I think almost unwittingly, to topple the government or to force President Hadi whose term had actually already expired anyway, to flee first Sana'a, the capital, and eventually to go to Saudi Arabia, where he said, please help to restore me to power. And the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia decided that they wanted to restore him to power. I think they thought it was going to be easy and quick. But again, he has basically no domestic following. And then in the meantime, he's these Houthis, who are the rebels who deposed him, teamed up with Saleh, who they had previously been at war with. And so now, you know, it's that group being attacked by Saudi Arabia. And it's, you know, it's gone on and on and on. The United States and the United Kingdom, as your caller pointed out, have, you know, made a point of really selling a lot of arms for this purpose. In fact, the Obama administration's sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia, predominantly for this war, exceed all other American weapon sales basically in the history of anything.
In fact, Reuters reported back in September that the United States sold Saudi Arabia more than $115 billion in weapons and other military equipment and training, the most of any administration in the 71-year U.S.-Saudi alliance. But then you had a few Democrats pressuring the administration to block arms sales to Saudi Arabia. And the New York Times reports in December that the administration did block a transfer of precision munitions to Saudi Arabia made by Raytheon, 16,000 guided munition kits worth about $350 million. But, I mean, before that, the weapons had already been sold, right?
You know, too little, too late, too whatever.
Why, Sheila, can you take us back? What was the justification for the United States, the Obama administration, selling the weapons to Saudi Arabia and supporting the attacks on Yemen?
You know, I mean, there's been, again, to put it, you know, briefly, there's been a very longstanding relationship between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United States that a lot of people label something like arms for oil. And so, you know, obviously the United States and many other countries in the world run a trade deficit with Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries that export oil. And, you know, the balance for that is selling weapons. So it is in part kind of a domestic jobs program, because these are, of course, very good industrial jobs. Probably the best industrial jobs left in America, and partly a foreign trade policy, and then also a security policy that I think, you know, with good reason, the Obama administration in particular, but but not only, have tried to keep it out of the headlines, because, of course, you know, it's rather embarrassing to be supporting the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which has, you know, an abysmal record on human rights, an atrocious policy on gender and other things. So, you know, it stays out of the limelight. But Obama himself, as president, visited Saudi Arabia at least six times. Last I looked that up, the only countries he'd visited more were the United Kingdom and Mexico. So, you know, they're a very, very close trade partner, not technically an ally. But since the Carter administration, if not before, it's been a cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy to support Saudi Arabia pretty much unconditionally.
Sheila Carapico is professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond and contributing editor of the Middle East Report. Today, we are talking about U.S. policy in Yemen. You probably heard about that January 29th U.S. raid, which killed 30 people, including women, children, and a U.S. Navy SEAL. Reuters reports that Donald Trump approved the action without intelligence, sufficient intelligence, ground support, or adequate backup. And The Guardian reports that he approved the raid over dinner with Jared Kushner and Steve Bannon. So we're talking today about what's happened under Barack Obama. The U.S. began backing the Saudi military attack on Yemen and sold Saudi Arabia a lot of weapons, and the U.S. also escalated drone strikes. So what's next? This is your call, and we'll be back after this.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at our website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio. Support for Your Call and other programs on KLW come from listeners and supporters such as Ron Rachusky and Nancy Swart of Oakland. Thank you for keeping the public in local public radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of the upcoming election in France. We'll also talk about the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' decision to approve the final phase of the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline following Donald Trump's executive order. The work on the final phase has already started. And also, with billionaires and lobbyists taking over the U.S. government, how are multinational corporations and Wall Street setting the agenda in Washington, and where is that reporting? And then next week, we're doing a week-long series on immigration. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, we'd love to hear from you. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about what's happening on the ground in Yemen. There is a humanitarian crisis happening there. According to official numbers, 10,000 people have been killed. Millions have fled their homes. 19 million people are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. Under Barack Obama, U.S. involvement in Yemen escalated. The U.S. conducted 38 drone strikes last year and backed the Saudi-led attack on Yemen. And then on January 29th, Donald Trump approved a raid that killed 30 people, including women and children. Reuters reports that Trump approved this action without sufficient intelligence, ground support, or adequate backup. And we're talking about this with Sheila Carapico, professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. She's contributing editor of the Middle East Report and editor of Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about what's happening in Yemen, and what happened under Barack Obama and what we can expect from Donald Trump? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Sheila, what is your analysis of what happened on January 29th? There are so many leaks coming out of the White House, and I've been repeating this, but Reuters says that this happened without sufficient intelligence, ground support, or adequate backup. The Guardian is reporting that Trump approved this raid over dinner with Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, and Steve Bannon, who now has a seat at the table for all foreign policy decisions. This is a man who recently ran Breitbart, which is a platform for white nationalists. What's your analysis of how this all went down?
You know, I'm not in a great position to comment on what went on inside of this White House dinner. But I can say a couple of things about the Yemen part of it. I mean, one is that, of course, there's two U.S. policies even under Obama that you mentioned. So we've been selling weapons to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and supporting them, I may add, actively in some other ways in their war against the so-called Houthis rebels. And then the drone strikes are a very separate operation. So the Saudis are bombing the enemies of al-Qaeda. And when the United States engages in drone strikes, as in this recent raid, that's against al-Qaeda. So that's part of a longstanding operation, which has primarily been a drone war. What makes this operation virtually unique is that it wasn't just drone strikes, which are remote control, but actual American and United Arab Emirates, Emirati personnel in the vicinity. So we have aircraft, and then in addition, apparently, because at least one of them was killed, we know, there were actually, as the expression goes, boots on the ground. That's very unusual, that the United States sends personnel into Yemen. And we know that we lost, I believe it's an Osprey aircraft, which I guess crash-landed or had a hard landing, they said, and then had to be destroyed. So this is a larger-than-usual operation, and so that's one point. Second point is it's still against the same family we've been killing now for quite a while. So one of the dead is the 8-year-old daughter of Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed in a drone strike some years ago, and then her brother also was killed. So this is part of an anti-Al-Qaeda operation. You know, so overall, clearly the Trump administration did approve the operation, but and specifically, it seems, approved, you know, the kind of escalation rather than just a drone strike, sending in personnel and evidently much more, manned aircraft and so forth than is usual. But it is on another level a continuation of the Obama policy. And I think it'll be a while before we understand to what extent. I mean, the Trump administration initially said, oh, well, this was planned under Obama. And then Obama's people denied that. I think it'll be a while before we can figure out how much of it was planned earlier and how much of it was really decided at a dinner. I mean, if they're making decisions like this over a dinner, that's pretty scary.
Mm. Well, and also, what about the larger picture here, Sheila, and what this means? The late young Yemeni writer Ibrahim Mothana, who mm-hmm. at the age of 24 died on September 5th. His family said he died from natural causes at his home in Sana'a. And in 2013, he told Congress, quote, "Drone strikes are causing more and more Yemenis to hate America and join radical militants. Unfortunately, liberal voices in the U.S. are largely ignoring, if not condoning, civilian deaths and extrajudicial killings in Yemen." During George W. Bush's presidency, the rage would have been tremendous, but today there is little outcry, even though what is happening is in many ways an escalation of Mr. Bush's policies. He went on to say defenders of human rights must speak out. America's counterterrorism policy is not only making Yemen less safe, but it could also ultimately endanger the United States and the entire world.
Well, yes. I mean, Mathena, who I knew, and there are a couple of other of his Yemeni friends who have continued to make that point. And this particular botched operation that resulted in, the death of an American and then of 30 Yemenis, not more than, as I've been able to count, 10 or 12 of whom could plausibly be called al-Qaeda, at least males of, fighting age, combined with what I just said a little while ago, which is that the United States is supporting the Saudis in a completely separate war. And that support, by the way, includes not only provision of weapons, but also things like in-air fueling, which is essential to the military operations, surveillance and targeting. So Yemenis have a sense that Americans have just sort of declared a free fire zone in Yemen. Mm. They're firing at one side and at the other side. And in this case, it's kind of a remote tribal area. The majority of the people killed were civilians. The imminent threat or the argument of an imminent threat simply hasn't even been put forward. There isn't evidence that this was some high-powered al-Qaeda operative where, the civilian deaths could be said, well, it was worth it for the collateral, the collateral damage was worth it because it's such a high-value target. I mean, none of that. So, yes, people, and there was never much anti-American feeling in Yemen at all, but now there is. I mean, you can find plenty of pictures of anti-American graffiti and a lot of, Twitter or any other social media, just sense of just, again, just sort of firing at will without even knowing who the target is, which is what it looks like in this operation.
Wow. What about Ibrahim Mothana's sentiment that he shared with Congress in 2013 about how liberal voices in the United States were largely ignoring what the Obama administration was doing in Yemen. And, I mean, let's be honest, Code Pink was always there, really raising awareness about the Obama administration's foreign policy and drone strikes. But other than that, it was pretty quiet. And do you think that now that Donald Trump is in office, the anti-war movement is going to pay more attention to these drones and these attacks and these raids?
I would be surprised. I mean, I give credit to Code Pink, and there certainly are a few other groups, you know, particularly human rights groups and ones that document war crimes and stuff like that. But even among those groups, it has been difficult to raise Yemen to the level of some other concerns that they have. You know, I personally, of course, you know, am very much a Yemen expert and try really hard to kind of keep that issue you know, somehow in the public eye, but it's been extremely difficult to get, you know, the so-called mainstream media or any media at all to cover it. Coverage is very light. Most people don't have any idea. It's a little bit complicated, so it takes a sort of complicated story to get any of it across. And then again, there are the arms sales, which I think for most congressional districts, states and congressional districts benefit from these arms sales one way or the other. And so the number of people in either the Senate or the House who are going to be willing to come out against that, you know, they're looking at what would be some pretty serious economic pushback from their constituents.
Will the arms sales continue under Donald Trump?
Oh, I would imagine so, yeah.
What about what we saw with the blocking of certain arms sales under Obama toward the end of last year?
You know, maybe. I must say I'm never comfortable commenting on specific arms sales because I just don't quite get which ones are which. So I'm a little cautious about what is the technical aspect of that. Why did they choose to block that particular arms sale, and I frankly don't know the answer to that.
Today we are speaking with Sheila Carapico, Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Richmond. She writes extensively about Yemen, and she's editor of Arabia Incognita.
Arabia,
thank you. Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. And we have time for another call. Let's go to Leslie in Berkeley. Hi, Leslie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. So, thank you. One historic point and one question. The historic point is that our mess in the Middle East, the United States complexity in the Middle East, vis-a-vis Yemen, goes back to the challenge U.S. took on to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. And if anybody remembers this little point, Yemen was split at one time during the Cold War, and the Yemenis were very aligned with the Soviets and spoke Russian. So the United States military hired Yemenis to go to northern Afghanistan to fight the Soviets at that time, and that's a part of the complexity that it involves a strain to the Yemenis politics now. But the other point. Or question is, I don't know where it's been reported or known, or maybe it is, that Hunt Oil, which I think it's, the name has been changed, but it's a Bush family oil company, has a port on the coast of Yemen, a small port with ships going in and out, and a pipeline coming through the country and supplying the ship, and it has continued to go unencumbered through this period of time and for years. And so there's an American company that is well connected at the very top, and who knows how the military, how what they know about it or not, or who anybody knows about it, but it's definitely a Bush oil concern. So I just wanted to share those two points. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Sheila, do you know anything about that?
Well, just very quickly. I mean, so there were two Yemens, South Yemen, which was pro-Soviet, and North Yemen, which was basically overshadowed or under the shadow of Saudi Arabia. And it was the North Yemenis who did indeed volunteer for the Afghan jihad against the Soviets. And yes, that is sort of the beginning of al-Qaeda in general, and then specifically of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Then the two Yemens unified in 1990, and the Soviets were gone by that time, of course, because the Soviet Union had imploded. Hunt Oil, I think, is not a Bush family operation, although I agree with the caller that it was is certainly supported by the Bush family and that they were very close, the Texas oil people. There are other American and French and international oil companies that operate in Yemen as well, through the port. I think she's referring to El Makalla, which is on the southern coast. The oil resources in Yemen are not that great, but, you know, I think we could never talk about the Arabian Peninsula without acknowledging both of the caller's points. One, that there is a Cold War history of this, and secondly, that, of course, oil is always a factor.
Well, thank you for the call. We have an email from Bill in Daly City who says, Trump approved one disastrous raid in Yemen and is being rightly criticized. Obama's policies resulted in thousands of women, children, and innocent men being killed in Yemen and other war zones in the Middle East, many more innocent people being killed as, quote, collateral damage and drone strikes, not to mention more immigrants being deported, more whistleblowers being prosecuted than any president before Obama, yet there were no massive demonstrations against these policies by the American public. Bill, we've talked about that a bit just a few minutes ago. What are your thoughts, Sheila, on how U.S. policy in Yemen will change under Donald Trump?
You know, the first question I would ask, and I and other, you know, people who watch this closely are also already asking, is he going to have any advisors who, for example, actually know where Yemen is, or any of the history, even that the caller and now this emailer know? You know, will people further down in the State Department? And frankly, the Obama administration was not exactly strong in this expertise either, because, again, they were so kind of beholden to the Saudis. That they accepted, I think, at face value sometimes what the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia said. I would be surprised if the Trump administration decided to go with, you know, some sort of expertise as opposed to business acumen on something like this. But, you know, maybe.
Mm. And who suffers the most? The people on the ground. I mean, the photos coming out of the UN are just horrific. People are holding babies, that an 11-month-old son that has hardly, I mean, he's just so emaciated. Yeah,
it's unbelievable. And the other thing about Yemen in contrast to Syria, and I think there are complex reasons that we're probably not going to go into right now why Syria gets so much more attention. Of course, the number of dead is much more. Whereas in Yemen, it's more the emaciation, the human suffering, the absence of real options for the refugees, because the Yemenis have nowhere to go. I mean, historically, Yemen has accepted refugees from Ethiopia and particularly from Somalia. The only place they can't go in, the Yemenis can't go into Saudi Arabia. Only the very wealthy can go into Oman or the Gulf. So their only options actually are to go to East Africa, where, you know, conditions are not very much better. So the crisis is really internally displaced people rather than people who are to make it out of the country.
What can people do about this, Sheila? Obviously raise awareness, but what organizations are doing critical work on the ground that people can contribute to or reach out to?
I mean, there are a number of, there are two kinds of organizations. Some of them are doing investigative work. Of course, those always include Human Rights Watch. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism has a quite good report on this raid out just recently. There's a group called the Yemen Peace Project, which raises some money. Oxfam has been active. Also, Médecins Sans Frontières, although, as you may recall, The Saudi-led coalition deliberately bombed a number of their hospitals, forcing them to curtail their operations, but they've still been doing quite a good job. And then, you know, more generally, I think, you know, people could certainly contribute to any of those organizations. The other thing is that this is so undercovered that, you know, like on my Facebook page, whenever someone who isn't also a Yemen specialist shares something about Yemen, I specifically thank them. And I would also specifically thank any of your listeners who, you know, whether it's on social media or in other ways, just, you know, to try to be a little bit more aware and conscious of what's going on, because as your other guest Shabia was saying, you know, the ignorance or the failure of people in the United States and the UK and Europe to even know this is going on, you know, is part of the problem.
Right. Well, and also the fact that Trump reportedly made these decisions at dinner with Jared Kushner and Steve Bannon got so much attention, but
right.
the humanitarian crisis really didn't. And finally, Sheila, just quickly, we've got about a minute left. Peace talks collapsed back in August. What role can the international community play in advancing some kind of solution to this crisis?
Boy, that could take us another half an hour. But briefly, the peace talks are a farce. Kerry has been treating... So the peace talks are organized by the U.S., the U.K., the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. In other words, by belligerents. Not as genuine peacemaking, but basically, you know, under the auspices of a party to the conflict. And their demand has been, the so-called peace talks basically call for the unconditional surrender of the people who are opposing the Saudi-led coalition. So unless or until either a genuinely neutral UN-led initiative on the global level, or, you know, a Yemeni-led genuine negotiation between and among the warring parties, but the you know, either of those might conceivably work, but the existing framework led by Kerry, which has been to kind of treat the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which again is responsible for most of that the known 10,000 deaths and other just destruction and starvation and stuff like that, to treat them as if they were making peace, is a mockery.
Well, we'll definitely continue following this. Sheila, thank you for joining us, and thanks for your work on Yemen.
I hope, continue following it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sheila Carapio is professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, and she's editor of Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. You can find out more about her work at yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produced today's show. Stephanie Purcell is our intern. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.